Hello, dear listeners, and welcome back to the Ajam podcast. I'm your host, Belle Cheeves, and I'm here with Niloufar Hayeri, professor of anthropology at Johns Hopkins University. We're going to discuss her 2021 book, Say What Your Longing Heart Desires, Women, Prayer, and Poetry in Iran. It's such a pleasure to finally meet you, Niloufar. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Of course. So in Say What Your Longing Heart Desires, you give your reader a beautiful account of how poetry helps shape and transform the religious lives and practices of a group of women in Iran. The ethnography traces this group of women and how the historic and culturally ingrained practice of poetry reading and recitation, and mystic poetry in particular, intertwined with prayer, helps them situate and better experience their relationship not only to ritual prayer, but also to God and to Islam. I'd love to begin our discussion with how you begin your book. You have this wonderful description of how you came to the project as someone who was rather allergic to religion, or as you say, running the other way whenever religion came up. Can you tell our listeners what brought you to this research?
Yes, sure. Thank you very much for the invitation to speak about my book. And I was going to Iran every summer to see my parents. But at some point, I decided to shift my fieldwork from Egypt to Iran. And I decided I will do fieldwork in Iran. And so I was trying to do a comparative ethnography of notions of modesty among Iranian Jews, Christians, and Muslims. And in fact, I was rather enjoying the fieldwork. But what happened is that, having been brought up in a religious family, I was always very close to people who prayed, who fasted, though far less regularly than their prayer, who went to pilgrimage and so on. And so I had many occasions to observe people who were praying in particular. And as I mentioned in my book, I went to visit a relative in the evening, and she asked me to sit in front of the television while she went to do her evening prayers. And, I really thought nothing of it because I had seen this all my life. But then she came out and she looked very serene and calm and with a little smile on her face. And she said rather sort of spontaneously, my prayers tonight went very well.
Right.
And I thought in my head, I thought, what does this mean, my prayers went well? Because this was ritual prayer. Uh-huh. I mean, I could have imagined if you spontaneously talk to God and you feel particularly close, okay. But a ritual prayer is a ritual prayer.
Right.
So at that point then, my curiosity was truly piqued. And I decided to follow what this means.
And not to spoil it for our potential readers, but for our listeners, what does that mean? What does it mean for the prayers to go well? I know it can take so many different meanings, but can you lay the groundwork a little bit?
Sure. For these women that I interviewed who were in their mid to late 60s, 70s, the situation with regard to namaz, the ritual prayer, as they explained to me, was different from their parents, not just their mothers, but also their parents. They told me that in their parents' time, namaz was something you did because it was an obligation. Islam required you to do it, and then it was finished. But for them, it was very important to try to not make it a habit, not make it mindless. And so they would choose particularly quiet places. For example, very often their own rooms, they would close the door, and they would, turn off their phones, and they would recite each word very slowly and carefully to try and think about what it is they wanted to convey to God. And this was another puzzle for me because I thought, once you say certain words, once you utter certain, that's what you're saying.
Right.
In effect, you know.
Right.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. That's Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. But then they told me that, no, you see, it depends on what is happening in their lives. And yes, they are saying those words, but while saying those words, they are asking God a question. They are asking for the health of one of their relatives, for their children's exams, and so on. And so this completely challenged not just my notion of what a ritual prayer is. It also challenged my notion of what is a language.
Right.
What is the use of language? You know, that form and content look like they always go together, but actually in these particular situations, they don't. So once they would manage to say to God what they wanted, which was a result of being able to concentrate, because mm-hmm. they mentioned without concentration, you really cannot be present.
Right.
In your prayer. So once they concentrated, once they were able to tell God what they wanted, this was a good prayer.
Thank you. So can you tell us more about these women? Who were they? And what were some of the other questions that they were grappling with while you were speaking with them?
Some of these women were friends of friends. So, and I would see them in poetry reading nights or, you know, an invitation here and there. And so they were very open to my tagging along and going with them to their classes. And I want to make sure that the listeners who are not that familiar with Iran understand what these classes are like.
Yes, please.
They are very much like book clubs.
Uh-huh.
Imagine book clubs on all kinds of things. Right? So you have a book club where you read poetry. You have a book club where you read the Quran. You have a book club where you talk about self-criticism and building yourself and improving yourself. You have, so there is a tremendous amount of seeking that these women are engaged in. And because they are all retired, they receive pensions because they mostly taught in public high schools. Mm-hmm. So they have some means. And so they get together a lot. They talk to each other a lot. In these conversations, a lot of things come up. The status of women mm-hmm. in Iran. How should youth be brought up and treated? What do we think of our values? Why is Hafez still relevant today?
Right.
So, yeah. So I hope that answered your question.
It does, yes. Thank you. So turning more to the poetry and to Hafez and mm-hmm. why he still matters. One of the chapters that I loved all of them. But before you dive more into what the women were doing and thinking during the time you interacted with them, you write about their childhoods in your first chapter. And it seems like it was during this earlier stage of life that poetry really started to shape their relationships to religion and also their questioning of some of the stricter or hypocritical, as you write, aspects of it. For example, poetry would often draw attention to hypocrisies of some religious practices or performances of piety as opposed to actual piousness. Can you tell us more about these earlier influences of poetry on the women that you interacted with?
Yes. You know, we should start from the fact that poetry has been the most important art form in Iran
yes.
for centuries.
Yes.
And how it is that Iranians have ended up with so many poets, nobody knows. But there's this vast body of poetry, which if you engage with, really teaches you a lot. You yes. might end up disagreeing with the poet, but it still makes you think about. It's
oh, absolutely.
Almost like reading philosophical and sociological analysis, but in the genre of poetry. So really, poetry is an uber genre.
Yes.
You do so much, you know, in with poetry. And as the most important art form for parents, I don't want to say all parents because one has to take into account that class is important. So, you know, middle class families, not necessarily elite aristocrats, which we don't have, but middle class families, even lower middle class families, because you see what happens is that poetry is paid attention to also at school. And right. we can talk about the, you know, how it is that this poetry, which so much challenges legal Islam, mm-hmm. legalistic Islam, is still taught at schools. But in any case, so at home, parents feel like in order to make their children become thinkers, pay attention to aesthetics, pay attention to religion, pay attention to divinity, and so on, one of the best ways to do that is to teach them poetry. The closest I can think of is when you have a seven-year-old playing Bach.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Right? So you know, you can't say that this seven-year-old really understands Bach, right? But something happens.
Right.
In that embodiment of that, you know, playing that music. Mm-hmm. And that's very similar to a seven-year-old little girl, you know, learning about Hafez, you know, memorizing five lines of Rumi. So this, again, challenged my idea of an aspect of language that we read a lot about, because, you know, my training is in linguistics, which is meaning, right?
Yes.
So we think of meaning as semantic meaning, lexical meaning. We might even say that different speakers have different meanings for the same word.
Right.
Nevertheless, what is challenged here is that there is a certain kind of meaning that comes with embodiment, which is not actually articulated linguistically. So if I am able to recite a poem by Rumi, even if I don't understand his mystical message, I am still embodying it. And in that, there is some kind of learning, there is some kind of understanding that I achieve.
Can you speak a bit more about the connection between poetry and religion as well, and how it helped these women in particular think about their religion?
Yes. In fact, you know, once I started to go to classes of poetry with these women, and I went to many because many of them were going to different classes, so mm-hmm. I ended up with, you know, and then I was going with them to their Quran classes. Eventually, what occurred to me is that the whole way we are taught about religion is very, very restricted and very limited. Imagine if I had gone through my academic training and been told, when you want to understand religiosity, don't just look at religion. Look at adjacent worlds.
Right.
Look at worlds that overlap. Right? Well, yes. I wasn't taught that. Right?
Right.
And so it took a while for me to realize that if I want to understand the religiosity of this woman, and this really became a very big question for me as someone who wasn't religious, is what does it mean to be religious?
Right.
Right? And then I asked myself, why are you surprised that they are so attached to this world of poetry?
Uh-huh.
Right? So it's very important to challenge our notion of religion, its boundaries, how other worlds make us understand religion.
Right.
And really, I can't imagine in Iran, if you don't know any of these poets and their poetry, that you really understand Iranian Islam.
Right.
You know?
One of the things that struck me in the book, especially as you write about the childhoods of the women, and then you mention this throughout the rest of the book as well, is the role of technology in mm-hmm. sharing these poetic and religious traditions, first via the radio and then television with poetry competitions, and then social media, of course. It seems like radio and television were initially quite helpful, or at least somewhat positive spaces for foregrounding some of the debates about religion. But then now it seems like television, and particularly social media, you say, I quote, have only increased the antipathy toward outwardly displaying one's piety. Can you tell us more about these shifts that you discuss in the book?
So there are several things here. One is that given that I was mostly writing for an audience who doesn't know Iran, and nor its history, nor its culture. Once you say poetry, in this country, you say poetry. Poetry sounds like this very niche, elite, intellectual, kind of sophisticated little corner of culture, right?
Right.
This obviously is a gross simplification of the role of poetry in the U.S. But I'm just trying to make the point.
Yes.
I wanted to show that something happened, which was, several things happened. One was infrastructure.
Right.
Right? So once you had radio in Iran in the 40s, mm-hmm. and you have one of the most popular programs that immediately takes hold is singing the poetry of all these beloved
yes.
poets, right?
Right.
That singing involves far more people than normal, because even mm-hmm. if you don't own a book of Hafez or you never pick up Rumi, but you hear this on the radio, and that melody stays with you. You start to hum it. There's that infrastructure, right?
Right.
And then in the 50s, television came. And again, one of the most popular programs was Moshaere, where you have, usually, 5 to 10 youth who compete with each other in exchanging poetry. So that infrastructure is very important.
Right.
The other infrastructure that's very important, of course, is social media. And I was very surprised, which I should not have been, but I was very surprised that almost all these women had Facebook accounts. Uh-huh. And it could be that their children have them, and so they want to have them. I don't know, but it doesn't matter. They exchange. and when they went to these poetry and Quran classes, they taped the classes.
Okay.
If someone was absent, they would send them the link or the recording so they could listen and take notes. But I want to say two more things. One is that even though this infrastructure was so important in spreading knowledge of this poetry and awareness of it and sort of love for it.
Yes.
The fact is that Iranian culture still depends a lot on getting together.
Right.
There's just one get together after another. And so that face-to-face, that very frequent face-to-face interaction is itself very important. For example, one thing I was very struck by is some of the women that when I got to know them better, they would say things like, at such and such point, when I was in a very difficult place in my life, my friend so-and-so gave me a prayer.
That's beautiful.
She gave me a prayer, and that prayer really helped me. You see, that's really interesting.
It is.
It's like giving somebody an object, like a nice book or painting or whatnot. So these exchanges also really spread this culture of poetry and its many, many functions.
So the title of the book, Say What Your Longing Heart Desires, is actually a line of poetry from mm-hmm. Rumi, describing a poem where Moses tells a shepherd that God has revealed to him that it doesn't matter what someone says in a prayer, but the fact that they say it with care and feeling is what truly matters. And to me, this really does encapsulate the beauty of what you discuss throughout the book, but particularly in chapter 3, where you focus on dua.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us more about this practice of dua or non-ritual prayer?
Yes. When I started my field work, I was so captured by the intricacies of namaz, the ritual prayer, that I spent quite a bit of time on that. However, I then knew that I will have to go to look at dua, because dua, generally, when people finish their namaz, they sit on their prayer rug and do dua. And dua is in Persian, if Persian is your mother tongue, and you basically talk to God, right? You talk about all kinds of things with God, right? And it is not an obligatory act for Muslims. You don't have to do du'a if you don't want to. And as I say in my book, I never ran into someone who said, oh, well, since I don't have to do du'a, I won't do du'a, right?
Right.
In fact, I think what happens, at least sometimes, is that namaz eases you into talking to God in a more intimate way, mm-hmm. in your own language.
Right.
And du'a allows these women to gradually build a more honest and more intimate relationship with God, right? Because if you think about it, say you've just started to do namaz and you're 18, mm-hmm. right? God appears to you as forbidding, maybe unapproachable, right?
Yes.
Maybe he's watching you all the time, and you know, maybe he's not, although I have to say he, in Persian, and in Persian we don't say he, we don't have he or she, but
yes.
In any case.
One of my favorite parts of the language.
Yeah, exactly. So with du'a, what happens is that you actually develop a particular relationship with God to the point where you can get angry at God, you can shout at God, or, you know, on the other hand, you can, you know, thank God, you know, all of that. But it's very much like one's relationship with another human being.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not simply that there is this God that I have to watch out what I say to, right?
Right. One of my favorite anecdotes you recount in the book, and also I would say one of the funniest stories in the book, is about a funeral. And mm-hmm. I realize that sounds horrible to say that it was funny and I loved it, but it just so perfectly encapsulates the manifestation of this tension at times between using Arabic and Persian. And I wanted to share it with our listeners. You write that one of the women, Maryam, went to a funeral and a man recited a du'a in Arabic and clearly had no idea what it meant because, I quote from Maryam, its text is full of curses, curse this, curse that. And this man just went on with this vulgar prayer at a funeral, and most of the people in attendance, including him, had no idea. Can you tell us more about these linguistic tensions and where they show up in the different debates about prayer that you address?
Yes. You know, there is, and there has always been, ambivalence toward Arabic. On the one hand, you know, Arabic is, classical Arabic is the language of the Quran. It's divine. It's the language of God. Iranians, on the one hand, very much admire it, feel awed by it, and at the same time feel insecure because they do understand that their pronunciation of the words, which are supposed to be very important,
right,
leaves a lot to be desired because, you know, Persian phonology is so different,
yes,
from Arabic phonology. So all of that, and the fact that, say, if you want to pray in such a way that you want to devote, you know, 19 Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim to the health of someone. It's very interesting because I asked several of these women, well, why don't you just say it in Persian? Just say in the name of God, the merciful, in Persian.
Mm-hmm.
And they they looked at me like, are you crazy? And the reason is that Arabic has this almost divine mystery.
Uh-huh.
It has this efficacy for talking to addressing God,
mm-hmm.
but not Persian. Persian has been greatly admired, but not because it's a divine language, not because it's a, so there is that tension. The other side of it is that some of the women, and in fact, men that I have talked to, they don't want to say the ritual prayer all the time in Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
So you have these videos circulating online where people are doing namaz in Persian, every single verse. And some of the women that I talked to, they said things like, well, you know, sometimes if I want to, I say one verse in Persian and one verse in Arabic, just like covering all verses.
You know? That works.
Yeah. So you see, there are these kinds. And to just remind the audience that since childhood, Iranians read the Quran in bilingual editions.
Right.
Which is something that I was extremely struck by when I did my first field work in Egypt, and I realized that there is no translation of the Quran in vernacular Arabic. And so if you don't know this very, you know, rather ancient form of Arabic and you read the Quran, someone has to tell you what it means. Though there's also another kind of meaning, which we don't have to get into now. But anyway, yeah.
So there are also written collections of Dua that you discuss. It isn't just this concept of sort of a spontaneous conversation, but there are books that give suggestions on what one might say for this non-ritual prayer. You write that there has been a burst in these prayer books written by women lately. Mm-hmm. I'd love for you to tell our listeners more about this. Mm-hmm. And I'm also very curious if you know a bit about the audiences for these books. You mentioned that they're bestsellers and award-winning, but also throughout the book, you note some of the gendered tensions between men and women when it comes to prayer and religious practices. So I'm wondering if the audiences are predominantly women or if men are also reading these prayer books that are written by women.
Mm-hmm. So this other kind of dua, which is written dua, we've also had for a very long time and refers to two different acts. One is when you just talk spontaneously to God, which we just talked about.
Yes.
But the other one is that many of the imams, many of the saints have duas attributed to them. And some of these are gathered in collections. You buy them, you recite them. They're all in Arabic because, of course, they were Arabic speaking. That's also dua. And then you have prayer books that, like you said, they give you occasion, like they say, on such and such occasion, you can do this dua, on such and such occasion, this dua. And then what has happened is that the definition of dua, whether consciously or unconsciously, has really expanded. So this is what really opened my eyes, that I went to religious bookstores in Qom, of which there are many. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that in the dua section, there are books written by young women mm-hmm. in Persian, whose style is characterized in Iran as simple irfan, simple mystical language. And they're very poetic. They're extremely popular. And they're produced beautifully. So it's interesting that those books would be put next to Imam's books.
Very much
right?
So. Oh, yeah.
In so many ways. I would say that mostly the audience is middle-class women.
Okay.
The books are not cheap. You know,
okay.
Yeah, they're usually not produced as in paperback.
Mm-hmm.
And so people give them as presents to each other.
Right.
They have beautiful hardcovers with paintings and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I would also say that younger men, the younger generation, you know, the generation who are in their 20s, they also read these books. And in fact, I came across reviews of these books written by younger young men who really praised the beauty of these
fantastic.
Books.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, that's very interesting. So thinking of these generational shifts, if you will, there are a couple of significant moments that you note throughout the book and how these women and Iranian society more broadly are approaching and understanding their religious practice, especially as it relates to the state. The big turning point was obviously in 1979 with the revolution that brought about the Islamic Republic. But you mentioned another shift after the end of the Iran-Iraq War in 1988. Can you tell us a bit more about these moments and how they shaped the experiences of your interlocutors?
Mm-hmm. You see, the war was quite devastating.
Yes.
Of course, it was also extremely devastating for Iraqis. I don't mean to say that this was a one-sided thing.
Of course.
It was very devastating. Do you know that before the Iran-Iraq War, we didn't have veterans?
Right.
There was no concept of veterans, right?
Right.
So many things happened. You know, cities started to get bombed. Families would leave cities and go in total darkness to the closest village, and they would find a place to sleep, you know. And then there was also the economy was devastated, so you had to line up to get flour and sugar. Absolutely something Iranians were not used to, right?
Right.
So there was a lot of hardship. There were thousands and thousands of young men and some women who were killed in the war.
Right.
Many families who lost sons and fathers and so on. So when the war ended, you can say that Iranian society felt a long moment of sobriety.
Mm-hmm.
It was such a sober moment. They had just had the revolution, and a few months later, you had the war. So before even fathoming what happened with the revolution and all the executions,
right?
Then you had the war, and then they had the devastation of the war. As life became a bit more normal after it ended, people resorted to these classes that I'm telling you, like
right.
the book clubs, like poetry nights, like, you know, getting together to read, even sometimes, you know, Carl Jung, you know. And there was this real search for what is going on in our lives? Who are we? Why did these things happen? And so on. And so there was this kind of mass education
mm-hmm.
that took place. And one of the things I argue in my book is that some of this education came from that body of poetry. Because you know how we are always supposed to be educated by Western thinkers, right? So we can't do without Western thinkers, of course. But of course, Iranians were open to Western thinkers as well. You know, you had Jung, and you even had series on Foucault, and you had this. I mean, it was just unbelievable. So this moment, I think, has been very important. I don't mean to say that it's lasting to this time that we're speaking, mm-hmm. nor will it last forever. But I feel like Iranian society changed, became more thoughtful, became more aware of itself, because we were so, during the time of the Shah, we were so oriented toward Europe and America
right.
that we know much more about them than about ourselves.
That makes sense. So moving beyond the book, I'm very curious if and how your experience with these women over years of fieldwork has shaped or contextualized your understanding of what's been happening recently with the Women Life Freedom Movement. In particular, in this protest movement, I'm curious if you're aware of instances of collective doa. This is something that you talk about in the book, and you say that it's often associated with climate change, for example, which I found very fascinating. And I'm wondering if you can speak about these threads.
Sure. I can say a few things about this. One is that actually with regard to collective doa, sometimes, not necessarily every time, but sometimes what happened in Quran or poetry classes or even poetry nights, which are different.
Uh-huh.
People would end up with singing a song together. Like, for example, sometimes the daughters of some of these women who played an instrument would come, and then they would, you know, at the end, to, you know, they would play a piece and everyone would sing, which was kind of like dua. Or they would actually say, you know, some dua, recite some short dua together. So that happened. The thing that's interesting is that these women went through a period where the authority to define Islam changed.
Right.
They became actors. they became people who believed that they can seek, they can read, they can add to their knowledge. They constantly talked about their own research, adding to their knowledge, adding to their thinking. And so in this process, of course, it also would, whether explicitly or implicitly, the question of equality between men and women would be embedded somehow there. And imagine that the daughters of these women, what are they told? They are told men and women are equal. They tell their daughters, go to school, you know, go to the university, do this, do that. Yes, you can learn music. Yes, you can become an architect. Yes, you can become. It's really the daughters of these women who are very much involved in woman life freedom.
Right.
The women life freedom movement. And I personally think, again, maybe I'm a bit too optimistic, Iranian society is perhaps one of the few Muslim majority societies where men have ended up believing that, yes, we are equal, that women are equal to us. And so if you remember when these demonstrations were taking place, many men came to the streets.
Yes.
Right? Now, that's incredible.
Yeah, right? It was.
Right?
It really was.
For a Muslim majority society, which has had and continues to have this suffocating patriarchy,
yeah,
right, especially as supported by the institutions of the state,
right,
and the legal institutions and so on, for them to reach this point, to come out to the streets to support their sisters and friends and mm-hmm. and so on, is, I think, a real achievement of the Women Life Freedom Movement.
Very much so. Well, I think that's a perfect note to end on. Thank you so much, Niloufar. It has been a pleasure. Listeners, if you would like to learn more, as there are so many more beautiful, rich aspects to this book that we did not even get to talk about, please get Say What Your Longing Heart Desires anywhere you get books.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you so
Thanks
much.
Very much. Yeah.